for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm, author of Dennis Johnson won a National Book Award for his Vietnam War novel, Tree of Smoke. For this month's Reader's Review, we've chosen his novella, Train Dreams. It's a profoundly American story in character and setting. The protagonist is a day laborer with the railroad and logging companies that transformed our nation. Through him, we see the wonders of industrial progress, as well as the loss and suffering inflicted along the way. Joining me in the studio, Ron Charles of The Washington Post, Michelle Nars of NPR, and Eric Rutko, an author and historian. I hope you'll join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good day to have you all here. Ron Charles, I'm going to start with you. What did you think of the book?
You know, this is the first novel I've read for fun in 15 years.
For fun?
Yes. I thought
everything
it was,
else
everything
you
else
had
is for work.
For work.
Not that I don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
I thought it was wonderful. Startling,
you did.
Startling and moving and really remarkable.
And so short, Michelle.
Digestible, yes.
Really? That he packs so much into this short novel.
It had the feeling to me like a great exhale. I loved it, too. And I found myself reading it, and I had to stand up when I read it, because I felt like I had to almost stand at attention. It felt like this big, long exhale, this gale force wind where he just sort of unloaded this this story.
That's
that washed over you. I loved it.
And Eric Rutko, how about you?
For me, it was just remarkable how many of the main themes in American history could show up in such a small number of pages.
Well,
we have everything from immigration and how that's shaping the country in this time period to, obviously, from my perspective, the way that we're relating to nature and trees and both how we're destroying the forests, but also how we're building society out of them, and the dangers and violence of nature, and trying to deal with those threats that are constantly out there. This is a very violent book. A lot of people reach ends in sort of morbid and often horrific ways.
Exactly. Well, and even the character himself, Robert, it's either Grenier or Grenier, and I'm not sure which. The novella opens with a horrifying scene, Michelle, that paints kind of an unflattering picture of Robert Grenier.
We don't want to give too much away because we really want to invite people to read this book, but it begins with the scene of a Chinaman, that's how he's described, being dragged up a mountain. And Grenier has to decide in a moment whether he watches, whether he's a bystander, or whether he's a participant. And in that moment, you learn quite a bit about him because he decides to participate. And actually, when others find it's difficult to hold on to this fellow's arms, he's kicking and fighting, Robert decides he's the one who actually is most committed to dragging this man up to the top of a mountain. And it is described that, you know, that the harder he fights, that, you know, whether they thought about making him dead, they were more committed to this. But as it gets difficult and difficult, some of them pull away, and he's more committed to that. And in that minute, you learn about the logging, you learn about his character, you learn about, you know, the immigration patterns that are shaping the country and the sort of ugly views that people have. And you learn about strength, both the external strength that takes to try to command nature, but something internal also about survival and how people view each other.
And Ron Charles, he regrets this for the rest of his life.
He's a fairly superstitious person, as I suppose many people were at that time. And the Chinaman, he gets the sense, is cursing them. Of course, he can't understand what the man's saying, but he definitely knows it's a curse of some kind. And he feels that curse for the rest of his life. As horrible things happen, he recalls it and remembers, maybe this is the result of that curse. And Eric can speak more to this, I'm sure, but tens of thousands of people from China were lured over here with the promise of work and then essentially discarded and treated horrifically.
Well, the Chinese Exclusion Acts, which are taking place in the 1880s, pretty much close down the entrance, and we start having new immigration groups come in. But when we think of things like the Transcontinental Railroads, obviously, from the western side, the transcontinental side moving east, was built almost entirely from Chinese labor. And the book does a good job, I think, of talking about some of the horrific conditions involved, where we hear about Chinese immigrants coming down in baskets to the sides of gorges with dynamite to blow out holes. Really remarkable scenes.
And, you know, you bring up such a good point. Remember, at first, I had thought that the railroad was built from east to west, but in fact, the two parts came together and didn't even meet. But here is this man, and I wonder why this book started this way with the Chinese character. What do you think, Eric?
That's an excellent question, is what I think. One thing for me that struck me, and I don't want to give too much away, is that...
You know, let me just say, this book has been promoted for a month. We have told listeners we were going to read it and talk about it. I do want to urge them to read it, but we're going to talk about this book, okay?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Spoiler alert.
Well, that being said, spoiler alerts. So in the opening scene, when they grab the Chinaman and drag him, what they're dragging him to is a trestle bridge that's spanning a gorge. And the incredible thing for me, and I didn't pick this up until later reading for me when I returned to the book, is that it was that wooden bridge that allows the fire that will consume the valley where he lives to reach his valley. So not only is the curse arguably based in superstition and concerns and someone speaking a language and seemingly being very concerned because they're about to be or almost are murdered, but that bridge itself is what will directly create the fire that consumes his house, his family, his entire life.
The Robinson Gorge Bridge, yes, that...
This is the Moyea.
Yeah.
So it's this idea of man and nature coming together, that wildfires happen, lightning strikes, drought conditions, but what actually allows it to spread so quickly is they built a wooden bridge that formed a span that let it jump the gorge.
Also, it plays right to his strengths that we see in Jesus' Son and in Tree of Smoke. He's great with acts of startling violence. And so the book starts with a bang.
You mean that this author,
yes,
over and over again,
right,
starts with a bang?
Yes.
Dennis Johnson is the author we're talking about. His book is titled Train Dreams. I hope whether you have read the book or not, there's so much to talk about here. Do join us. This author is the winner of the National Book Award. He's the author of 6 novels, 3 collections of poetry, and 1 book of reportage. The Tree of Smoke was the 2007 winner of the National Book Award. You know, I'm curious about the fact that this book was shortlisted for a Pulitzer. No novel won the Pulitzer this year, which created lots of discussion. Ron Charles?
Yeah, I was really angry about that. There were plenty of good novels to nominate and should have won last year. The fact that the list only had 3 books. One was a novel, one was a novella published 10 years ago, and one was an unfinished manuscript. I thought that was ridiculous.
Why do you suppose the Pulitzer Committee got to that point this year?
I don't know why the judges didn't pick other novels. There were plenty of them. There was Doc. It's easy to second guess judges. They have a lot of books coming in, but I thought it was a really peculiar list of finalists.
You know, Michelle, this fellow, Robert Grenier, is really a survivor. As much as is poured on him in the way of tragedy and, I don't know, loss, he comes through. How come?
You know, there's a moment in the book where he has gone to face his demons and search for his wife and daughter, and living near the homestead that was destroyed by this fire. And there's he goes from this passage of being spiritually unhinged, where he's hearing voices and seeing things and longing for his wife and daughter, and he sort of emerges from that years later with this a trusty companion, the red dog. And then he becomes physically unhinged, literally. I mean, a tree hits him in the jaw, and his jaw never closes quite the right way. And then the joints all down his body stop working. And yet he continues to sort of, you know, move forward. And that was, you know, one of those moments where it helped me sort of create a vision of this person who was sort of ambling through life. And you're sort of moving forward and backward. You're in the moment with him, but he's constantly, you know, reaching back and trying to understand a past. And in part of what moves him forward, I think, is that yearning for a past that he can't remember. He arrived in this big open space as an orphan with only a little bit of a memory, with a note pinned to him that was, you know,
he
the backside
has no
of
idea
a receipt.
Who his parents are.
And that's sort of what he's sort of, I think, searching for throughout.
That's a classic American theme, right? People come here, they start over, they can become whoever they want to be, they reinvent themselves, or they don't have a past, or they make a usable past out of nothing. The book stems right out of other books that Hemingway has written, and Thoreau, Cormac McCarthy, Annie Proulx. It's a really in a grand tradition of American fiction here.
Ron Charles, he's fiction editor for The Washington Post. Michelle Nara, she's author of The Grace of Silence. And Eric Rutko is an attorney and historian, author of American Canopy, Trees, Forests, and the Making of a Nation. Short break here. We'll be right back. And for this month's Reader's Review, we're talking about Dennis Johnson's book, Train Dreams. It's a novella and a very lovely book, 116 pages, all about the development of the country and what happens to people and the landscape along the way. Michelle Norris is, of course, with NPR, Ron Charles, The Washington Post. Eric Rutko is the author of a new book, American Canopy, all about the trees and forests of America. Michelle, read a little bit for us from this book.
At your invitation, I'm going to read a section where Grainier is bringing home Hood Sarsaparilla to his wife and daughter. It's something that she loves, and he thinks it might help her because she's feeling ill. He gave the hoods to Gladys. She sat up in bed by the stove, nursing the baby at her breast, down with a case of the salt room. She could easily have braved it and done her washing and cut up potatoes and trout for supper, but it was their custom to let her lie up with a bottle or two of the sweet-tasting hoods tonic when her head ached and her nose stopped, and get a holiday from such chores. Grainger's baby daughter, too, looked roomy. Her eyes were a bit crusted, and the discharge bubbled pendulously at her nostrils while she suckled and snorted at her mother's breasts. Kate was 4 months old, still entirely bald. She did not seem to recognize him. Her little illness wouldn't hurt her as long as she didn't develop a cough out of it. Now, Grainger stood by the table in the single-room cabin and worried. The Chinaman, he was sure, had cursed them powerfully while they dragged him along, and any bad thing might come of it. Though astonished now at the frenzy of the afternoon, baffled by the violence, at how it had carried him away like a seed in the wind, young Grainger still wished they'd gone ahead and killed that Chinaman before he'd cursed them. He sat on the edge of the bed. "Thank you, Bob," his wife said. "Do you like your sarsaparilla?" "I do, yes, Bob." "Do you suppose little Kate can taste it out of your teat?" "Of course she can."
It's just such a wonderful scene, such a personal encounter that he has with his wife as she suckles the baby.
And I think that this is one of the scenes that humanizes him very early on. So we're first introduced to him in one of the worst moments of violence in his life, one
exactly.
of the worst moral decisions he makes. And then we turn immediately to seeing that he's a family man, that he seems to have great respect for his family, that he wants to comfort his wife. And so we have these two sides of this man, a very hard side, a very pragmatic side, and a very loving and caring side. And that tension is going to be developed over the course of the book. So in these opening scenes, we really get a sense of who he is.
And Eric, you write a lot about this entire era in your own book, American Canopy, talking about the trees and the forest. How big a role did the trees and the forest play in the development of this country?
Well, I would tell you that perhaps the biggest role of all. certainly, if we think of the resources that we used, and if we think of the landscape and how it shaped us and how we in turn have shaped that over time, I think that it's very easy to point to trees. And this novella does a great job at supporting that argument. We can see that most of his employment is directly involved in the forest. He's either chopping down trees. He goes to Washington to do that. He has some smaller jobs around Idaho doing that as well. And I should say that at this time, there is a massive lumber industry in northern Idaho as well. Just a huge volume of timber is coming out in the first 25 years of the 20th century. And then at the same time, we can see that it's a fire that will destroy a forest, and then that will be the forest was his home. And without that, he has to rebuild again. And what is the home he builds? He chops down some spruce trees and begins to stack them, and over the course of labor, builds himself a log cabin.
And there's so much danger involved in this cutting of trees, and people are killed in the process, Ron Charles.
Yeah, what was the line you mentioned?
Michelle? A tree is your friend as long as you leave it alone.
Yeah, as soon as the blade touches it, you're at war with it. Yeah, there's some horrendous deaths here.
An older man who you mentioned earlier is responsible for setting the charges. He's one who gets killed. Another.
Is he the one that's drying dynamite in his stove? I love that.
He's the one who goes into when the charge doesn't
exactly.
work. He walks in and makes sure that the wires are set correctly and then
right.
comes out and yeah. charges it again. I think he was killed by the falling branch.
Oh, right. right.
A widowmaker.
The widowmaker.
It was another
yeah.
man
widow
who was drying
maker.
Dynamite in his
yeah.
stove, which you shouldn't do.
We've got a caller in Towson, Maryland, who'd like to be part of the program. Let's go to Ed. Good morning to you, sir. You're on the air.
Good morning. There's such good luck, because I didn't know you were doing the book review of Train Dreams today, but I just finished it myself over the weekend. And so I wanted to comment. I agree, you know, pretty much everyone has said it's a remarkable book for being such a short book, covers so much. But I also really enjoyed the lyrical passages, almost like poetry, some of the descriptions of the nature that I guess we're seeing through Grainger's eyes, like there was a scene in a book where I think cattle's driven across the lake, the frozen lake, and the snow's, the cattle rolls up the snow to it, like covers everything, and it just that whole description of that passage. I don't have it in front of me now, but And there was quite a few passages like that that, to me, it was almost like poetry. And that was another thing I really enjoyed about the book.
Ed, I'm so glad you read it and so glad you enjoyed it. A lot of people have said this reads kind of like poetry, Michelle.
It does. And there are moments, I mean, the place that... One of the places where I really got lost is when he goes back and he's searching for his wife and daughter and realizes that everything in the valley has been consumed by fire. And he's describing, you know, there are just little asides that he makes, that he finds the cook stove and it's on its side and its legs are bent in like a dead beetle. And, you know, and you can just picture this. It's so evocative. But the moment where Gladys, a woman who we learn he loves so much in that passage,
he adores,
returns to him and gives him a strange gift, the description of what happened to their home when the fire took the building. It is a breathless read, and it's as someone who often talks about wildfires in the summer months. You know, you talk about the fire usually from above, from the people who are fighting fires. You never really get the description of what it's like to be in the middle of one of them.
And I hope you will find that passage and read it for us, Michelle, because...
It's one of the things that creates tension in the novel, just as it moves from very peaceful settings to very violent settings. It also moves from very simple, plain language to very evocative lyrical language in a startling way. There's this one little line, "The butterflies fluttering magically like leaves without trees." That's not a plain line. That's a remarkably poetic line.
Absolutely. Have you found it, Michelle?
Thanks to Eric, I did.
Please.
Gladys is she's speaking to her husband. She's returned
through a dream.
Through a dream, but it feels altogether real because the dog has bristled. The dog is sensing that something really is in the room, and she describes what's happened and that her daughter hadn't come across among the spirits, but lingered here in the world of life, a child alone in the burning forest. But the forest isn't burning, he told her, but Gladys couldn't hear. Before his sight, she was living again in her last moments. The forest burned, and she had only a minute to gather a few things and her baby and run from the cabin as the fire smoked down the hill. Of what she'd snatched up, less and less seemed worthy, and she tossed away clothes and valuables as the heat drove her toward the river. At the lip of the bluff, she held only her Bible and her red box of chocolates, each pinned against her with an elbow, and the baby clutched against her chest with both hands. She stooped and dropped the candy and the heavy book at her feet while she tied the child inside her apron, and then she was able to pick them up again. Needing a hand to steady her along the rocky bluff as they descended, she tossed away the Bible rather than the chocolates. This uncovering of her indifference to God, the Father of all, this was her undoing. 25 feet above the water, she kicked loose a stone, and not a heartbeat later, she'd broken her back on the rocks below. Her legs lost all feeling, and she wouldn't move. She was only able to pluck at the knot across her bodice until the child was free to crawl away and fend for itself, however briefly, along the shore. And this goes on and on. You see another dilemma, a moral dilemma, and she goes on to describe what happens in the house. The logs in the wall stressed and popped like large bore cartridges going off. On the table by the stove, a magazine curled, darkened, flame spiraled upward and flew away page by page, burning and circling. The cabin's once glass window shattered. The curtains began to blacken at the hems. The wax melted off the jars of tomatoes, beans, and Canada cherries on a shelf above the steaming kitchen tub. Suddenly, all the lamps in the cabin were lit. On the table, a metal-lidded jar of salt exploded, and then the whole structure ignited like a match head.
Michelle Norris reading from Dennis Johnson's novella, Train Dreams. Those are such powerful passages, and to learn how she died made me wonder whether he imagined it or whether she truly, in some kind of dream, came to him. What was your thinking, Ron?
I don't know, because Johnson has written before about drug-induced visions. There are visions in here that aren't drug-induced, but they seem visionary to me.
And he was living on mushrooms at the time.
He was, indeed. What do you think? think, Eric?
I think they were morel mushrooms, but I take the point.
Yeah.
There's another passage where he mentions, and this is on page 47. This is after there's been the fire, but before he's rebuilt his home. He stayed on for weeks in this camp, waiting, wanting many more such visions as that of the bonnet and the chocolates, as many as wanted to come to him. And he figured that as long as he saw impossible things in this place and liked them, he might as well be in the habit of talking to himself too. Mm-hmm. And so to me, at this early stage in the novella, he seems to acknowledge that there are impossible things he's seeing. As the book goes on, his own sense of what may be impossible and what may be real seems to begin to blur. So that by the final sort of dreamlike episodes that we're dealing with, it's much harder to have a real feel for what Grainier thinks or what the narrator himself seems to think of the situation. And it becomes very ambiguous, but leaves a lot of space and I think plenty of clues for a reader to decide how to interpret that.
And perhaps a suggestion that your history can set you free. Because that is when Gladys comes back to him, that is the moment that he starts to at least spiritually heal and move forward.
Right. I think visions have gone out of style because we're so scientific and so sophisticated. But for a long, long time, people trusted visions. They trusted dreams. They thought they had real value. And I think that's embedded
in
his way of life.
Ron Charles, fiction editor for The Washington Post. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Our lines are open. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. How does Grainier, however you choose to pronounce it. He's a loner. But how does he interact with his community, Eric?
He's genuinely an honest fellow outside of a few moral instances we see, and it's stressed early on that he doesn't drink and he doesn't chase women. And other than a brief stretch in his late teens where he was sort of a layabout, he pursues honest work and tries to treat people fairly. So for the most part, he attempts to interact honestly, and what we see is him struggling at times to navigate a world where people have a lot of confused intentions, where people know that life is hard, and people know that people do die suddenly, and that the morality of how to interact with each other is often shaped around this understanding that a man that makes it to 40 years old in this territory has outlived many of his peers.
He doesn't have much money as time goes on. How does he live? How does he support himself, Michelle?
He off the kindness of other people, you know, essentially. And you see this man slowly going mad, you know, and trying to hold on to something. And it's really how he gets by, is this sort of cast of characters that come into his life at the very end of his life.
And you think he truly goes mad?
You know, that's the way I read it, that, you know, and he talks about, I was just looking for this, where he talks about acknowledging that something terrible had happened deep down inside of him. And it seems like that sort of break with reality, this war, you know, inside of him, and one seems to get on top of the other.
All going back to both the Chinaman and the loss of his wife and daughter.
I would agree with you that it does seem he goes mad, but I would qualify that to within his 1 acre of land where the cabin existed. Mm-hmm. It seems when he goes out into the world and deals with other people, and he sort of has a small hauling business that he handles for a few years.
Right.
He never seems to do anything that strikes me as particularly strange or odd. In fact, at one point he questions, am I a hobbit, mm-hmm. right? Or a hermit, excuse me.
Yes.
Am I a hermit? And so there certainly does seem to be a sort of madness that arises in this one special place that's been destroyed and rebuilt, where he had everything and everything was taken from him. But when he goes out into the broader world, he strikes me as sort of a laborer, as a man without a specialized skill set, who is available for whatever tasks are at hand, and that carries him for a long time.
But you know, it's fascinating, even in that exchange you read about the sarsaparilla, Michel, his wife seems to have a greater understanding of the world than he does. He seems, shall I call it, slow? He seems non-comprehending of the world in comparison. What do you think, Ron Charles?
I don't know if I agree, because if the book represents his perspective and his experience of the world, he's so sensitive to other people's experiences.
And yes.
One of the most, we haven't talked about it yet, but some of the most startling parts of the book are these other stories we get, like the story of William Coswell Haley, the pedophile who dies there by the tree, or the man who was shot by his own dog. I mean, we only have those stories because Robert listened to them in a particular way and conveys them to us in this narrative, which suggests that he is extremely sensitive to the world around him.
Or that people are sensitive to him. Because in the case of the man he meets in the woods, it's almost like he was chosen. Like, this is, I am going to, before I leave this earth, I'm going to give my story to you.
Michel. And he heard it.
Mm-hmm. Michel Narizeb, NPR, and author of The Grace of Silence. Short break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By Staples, offering forever postage stamps, like at the post office. Staples has postage stamps. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, pianist Jeremy Denk talks about his new album of Ligeti piano etudes and Beethoven sonatas. You've got to be pretty obsessive to tackle some of these, and apparently he is. Join us.
And let's go right to the phones as we talk about a book titled Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson. To Wilkesboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Scott. You're on the air.
Good morning. I appreciate you taking my call. I was listening to the description of the beginning of the book with the fire leaping across the bridge. And then you're talking about the expansion by a train coming across westward expansion. Is there a subtle critique of westward expansion that's going on here? I'd be curious about the comments.
What do you think, Eric?
I think that there are critiques of aspects of how it was done. But I think that Dennis Johnson seems more interested in playing with themes and tensions in the American experience than throwing this out there as a polemic. It certainly doesn't feel that way to me. So I would say that it's more a question of the drive to Western expansion brings forth all of these tensions in
how
the American experience.
Yeah.
How do we interact with nature? How do we interact with others, whether that be Native Americans, whether that be immigrants that come in? How does modernity reflect on this? What is the role of the railroad? Is it a force of progress or a force of destruction? And so it doesn't strike me as much as a critique, as much as trying to recreate that scene to sort of allow you to understand what were those tensions and what did it look like.
Michelle?
You know, we were talking about a question off mic about whether this was really a rumination on him or whether it's really about the westward expansion in America and the growth of railroads. And this reader, me, I was sort of more focused on him. And this note, you know, at the end, because it says so much about the span of his life and I guess how that plays out against the backdrop of the growth of the railroads, you know, he'd, through his life, had one lover, his wife. He'd owned 1 acre property, 2 horses and a wagon. He'd never been drunk. He'd never purchased a firearm or spoken into a telephone. He'd ridden on trains regularly, many times in automobiles, and once on an aircraft, which is a hilarious scene in a very entertaining moment in the book. And during the last decade of his life, he watched television whenever he was in town. He had no idea who his parents might have been, and he left no heirs behind him. It says so much about the span of his life, as you know, compared or as set against that backdrop. But the one thing I would suggest for people who have read this book or who well read it, perhaps a companion read, is a larger novel by, at least larger in size, but similar in scope and in focus, Ron Rash's novel Serena, which is also about the taming of the, you know, the forests in the West and in the Middle West. And many of the characters that you meet, the loggers and the sawyers, are quite similar. And the sudden death and the sort of battles with nature. We were talking about
that. Yeah, that's one of my favorite novels of
is
the last
it
few
really?
Years. It's remarkable. It's gothic, so it has a totally different tone
all right.
in this book.
We'll put that on our list. However, back to Train Dreams. This gets weird at the toward the last third of the book. Again, the question is whether it's reality, whether it's something going on in his head because he is so alone. There's the dog that shoots the man. There is the appearance of a she-dog, that a she-wolf who may represent his daughter, his long-lost baby daughter, who the narrator somehow implies that she escaped when her mother fell and broke her back and drowned and was raised by wolves. Mm-hmm. What did you make of that, Eric? You're laughing.
No, I went back to reread that, and I found that those scenes made a lot more sense to me the second time around.
Why?
So part of the reason why is that it's set up very well. So part of it is just as a matter of craft and writing. He does an excellent job of dropping subtle hints along the way of what's to come. One of them that I think is really interesting is in the same scene we were reading earlier about the sarsaparilla, which is at the very, very beginning of the book. If you go to sort of the next scene forward, it's about a page forward, there's on page 9, he says, "In the dark he felt his daughter's eyes turned on him like a cornered brute's. It was only his thoughts tricking him, but it poured something cold down his spine. He shuddered and pulled the quilt up to his neck. All of his life, Robert Grenier was able to recall this very moment on this very night." So we're 9 pages into the book, and we already have this subtle hint that there may be something to come. And we've had so much preparation for his sort of, I don't know if we want to call it madness or his visions within where he is, that we've been very well set up to the experience of this daughter. But what's really interesting to me is that it's not just the scene of this sort of wolf child as daughter visiting him towards the end, but the very, very last scene in the book, the way the book actually closes, is a false wolf child in a carnival. He goes to a fair, and we've jumped forward about 30 years. So now we're in, I think this is the 1950s at this point, maybe 60s?
60s.
And it's what I found very interesting was that when the wolf child, when he thinks it's his daughter visiting him, it's this mixture of myth as reality, nature and man combining. And we jump forward 30 years, And myth and reality are sort of gone now. The whole audience knows that this is a show, that this isn't real, and they're actually laughing at this wolf boy. And then what is weirdest of all is the final paragraph, where the wolf boy leans back his head and releases essentially the primal scream of nature, which to me reflected this ongoing tension of myth, reality, nature, and man. All is captured in that last moment.
But doesn't Robert Grenier also do this howling himself?
As sport.
As sport.
And he's training his puppy how to be a wolf. Right?
So
he howls to the wolves, they howl back.
And
it's
they
a remarkable
howl
scene.
Back. Here's an email from Colleen in Mason, Ohio, who says, this was an amazing book, such an epic story in such a small package. Why, with the scope of the story, do you think Dennis Johnson chose to write it in novella form?
He can write long. I mean, the Tree of Smoke
is 600 pages.
Tree of Smoke is a long, huge, rambling novel.
Is it really?
Yeah. This is not. I think it makes different demands. He wants to try different
himself,
challenges.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so you have this compression of ideas, of facts, of happenings, and then all of this sort of wolf child built in.
And yet he introduces us to so many people along the way and so many scenes along the way. That's one of the amazing things about this book, is you would assume that the through line would be very linear.
Right.
And yet there are characters who are, and through in one or two sentences, you know all you need to know about someone.
That is really hard to do, and he does it just expertly, I think.
Here's another email from John. Let's see. He says, such an astounding piece of fiction, stark and revealing. It calls to mind a simplified Cormac McCarthy style, as if that were possible. It also reminds me in its simplicity of a movie called The Straight Story, which chronicled the story of a dying man who wanted to make amends with his brother and cross the plains by way of tractor. The similarity is in the purity of soul and self-revelation. Of course, there is not quite purity of soul here, if you think back to the Chinaman, Eric.
He's made a few moral judgments in his life that he thinks are very questionable, and the Chinaman is the most notable one, and I think there's a good reason why that opens the book. But what's interesting to me is he still seems to represent the closest thing to a moral core in the universe that he inhabits, in the sense that he's a fairly honest man, and he's not really trying to go out of his way to harm anyone. And we see episode after episode where he encounters people that have been wronged or suffered, or sometimes themselves are looking to be the bad actor and looking to exploit people. And he functions for us as the reader, I think, as something of a moral voice in interpreting what's going on around him.
What about the local Native American culture and what kind of an effect that has on Grenier, Michelle?
That there is this, you know, some of it is hard to read. And I guess that is in keeping with the time period and with the way Native Americans were reviewed then, but there is this. He almost stands between the people who are casting judgment and the people who are being judged. I mean, he's sort of he's not necessarily wagging a finger, but he's sort of the filter that that you see all this through. Whether it's the woman who sort of paints herself with sloppy red lipstick, or the squaw that he encounters later in life, and just the saying or the reading of that word is something that, right now makes us bristle.
Sort of shocking.
Yes, exactly.
To see it.
But he's the sort of filter that we see all this through, and it is less shocking because you sense that he feels something that is not quite right about this.
My sense of this is that when we look through Grenier's eyes, he actually sees Native Americans somewhat as sort of complete equals. So there's one character, Kootenai Bob, mm-hmm. And Kootenai Bob is a laborer, just the same way the main character
is.
And when he describes Kootenai Bob the first time, he essentially says, he's a laborer just like me, seems like a nice guy, we talk to each other every so often. Then when that same person is seen through the eyes of the guy whose dog shoots him, right, now Kootenai Bob is a beggar, effectively, mm-hmm. who sort of walks over, chats, but ultimately is asking for money. And so I think that that tension is captured very nicely there. But I do agree with you, some of the language, it's a little hard to know, is it sort of through the protagonist's eyes, through the narrator's eyes, what are we supposed to do with this language? And that can be a little bit tricky, and it can be jarring at times.
Mm-hmm. Right. Coming here, I wonder, what would it be like to read this as someone from China or as a Native American Indian? Because we all grew up on these stories of loners, that is, white American males who are out there in the forest on their own, and we know these are the moral heroes, and they're the moral heroes of our national imagination. Then when you get readers from different ethnic backgrounds, you get a very different impression of our national literature, and I wonder how that would change your impression of this book. I don't know. I think it would.
That's an interesting conversation. I would be interested to
Michelle Norris. She's the author of The Grace of Silence, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. To Valerie in Alexandria, Virginia, good morning to you.
Hi. How interesting. What a wonderful book. Amazing. Really amazing. I'm a French-Canadian, and I come from a town called Chicoutimi, where got burned down about the same time of where the story is taking place. And so lots of my ancestors moved to the West as loggers or all sorts of different trades. They covered the gamut over there. And one interesting point that I'm seeing is the name Grenier. Grenier in French means it's in a holding spot for grains, wheat or all sorts of things. And to me, his name means that he's the holder of something, a past or a sense of a knowledge, right? So this is, as a French-Canadian, this is what I'm reading through. Because he's sent as a French-Canadian to another French-Canadian family. They may have been there, you know, an earlier generation. But this is my reading of it.
That's very interesting, Herrick.
That's interesting, and I wasn't aware of that. I would say that if that's the case, it may be that he's sort of an empty vessel that is going to be filled up. And what is it that's filling him up is sort of this nature that encounters him and the experiences. But we don't know that he's French-Canadian. It's only sort of implied. It's also suggested by his cousins that he could be Mormon. And this is the challenging thing. Hmm. I think to American ears, we see it and you go to Mount Rainier immediately because that seems to be more of the association. But I don't know that that's necessarily meant to express something specific. I will say I sort of did not try to overthink what the name was, acknowledging that it may have a lot of resonance. I don't know if you guys had sort of thoughts on that.
Well, but the French-Canadian thing is very interesting because he, again, doesn't have this memory of his background, but it is suggested by one of his cousins that he came speaking French, and they had to beat the French out of him, so he was accepting of what they called, I think, the native tongue or the mother tongue, which, of course, would be American English.
That was done to the Indians, too, in some parts of the country, right? It was their native languages were beaten mm-hmm. out of them.
Can somebody explain to me very quickly how the dog shot the man?
Oh, it is sort of ambiguous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more than ambiguous. Can you, Eric?
I don't know that I can. The person who was shot was so reticent to say it that our main character threatened to throw him off the side of the road, which would have killed him, actually, if he didn't explain what happened. And even then, we don't get a complete story. So
it's a great bit of dialogue.
It is a great
surprisingly
bit of dialogue.
Comic, I think.
And just one of many, many mysteries in this tiny little book. And it's interesting. On the cover, you have the train moving along with the horse moving even faster. What that indicates, who knows?
Who's going to win? You know, it is, you look at this and you wonder, it's, you know, man versus nature.
Was it worth it? Thank you all so much for joining me. Pardon me, Ron Charles of the Washington Post, Michelle Norris, author of The Grace of Silence. She is a voice at NPR. Eric Rutko, attorney and historian, author of American Canopy, Trees, Forests, and the Making of a Nation. For next month's Reader's Review on Wednesday, June 27th, we'll discuss Tinkers by Paul Harding. Tells the story of a New England patriarch at the end of his life, reflecting back on his early years and his relationship with his father. I hope you'll join us for that, June 27th. Thank you all so much.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurov-Livker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from